focus on the dorsal gradient, and I'm going to try to convince you that the combination of some of the new technologies that have been available over the past year or two, microarray assays and bioinformatics, has in fact pushed the problem forward of how a regulatory gradient produces different thresholds and controls embryonic development. Normally I try to give like a fancy schmancy grand synthesis talk with little vignettes and sleight of hand and big lists of interesting genes, but I really want to focus on, do these methods help in pushing the problem forward of how a gradient generates multiple thresholds? And if I could just have the lights down, I think I need them off. So the regulatory gradient I will focus on this morning is called dorsal. This is a member of the RHEL family of transcription factors. It is related to a very famous mammalian protein called NF-kappa-B. The dorsal protein is actually synthesized during oogenesis, and it's distributed throughout the cytoplasm of the growing egg and the early embryo. But 90 minutes after fertilization, protein begins to move from the cytoplasm and enter nuclei. And that's what you can see here. This is a high magnification view of a 90-minute embryo stained with an antibody against the dorsal protein. I'm sort of proud of the fact this is a very old slide. It goes back to an experiment from a former postdoc named Christine Rushlow back in 1989. When I was a young Turk, many years ago it seems, I always wanted brand new slides. I figured, you know, if it's more than 6 months old, you know, I'm losing my touch. Now I'm kind of proud of the fact that having old slides still bear some relevance to the problems we work on. So you can see the protein enter nuclei here, but it remains in the cytoplasm there. I will refer to this as a gradient, but remember it's a nuclear gradient. It's an activity gradient with peak dorsal activity in ventral regions, progressively lower activity in lateral regions of the embryo, and finally little or no dorsal activity, no dorsal protein entering nuclei in dorsal regions. And in case I forget to mention this, at the very least, this gradient generates three different thresholds of gene expression. I'm going to argue for a fourth threshold towards the end. And these thresholds of gene activity are important for initiating the differentiation of three basic tissues in the early embryo, the mesoderm, the neurogenic ectoderm, and the dorsal ectoderm. I'll try to repeat that in the course of the talk, but just in case I forget. So this gradient controls dorsal ventral patterning by regulating a number of target genes in a concentration-dependent fashion. So by 2 to 2.5 hours after fertilization, you can begin to see all sorts of localized patterns of expression. I'm guessing that you've seen some of these from Eric Wishaus's talk earlier in the meeting. And a couple of examples of some of the dorsal target genes are shown here. And in fact, I'm gonna also mention some genes that Bill showed at the very end of his talk earlier this morning, where he's doing that multicolor nuclear dot, some of the same genes. And this summarizes our view of how the dorsal gradient worked about 10 years ago, based on studies done by a number of former associates in the lab, particularly Christine Rushlow, Jean Jang, and Tony Ip. And the view is this: high levels of the dorsal protein activate target genes such as SNAIL and restrict their expression to ventral regions that form the embryonic mesoderm. And the reason why only high levels of the gradient can activate SNAIL expression is because the SNAIL cisregulatory DNA contains a series of imperfect, low-affinity dorsal recognition sequences. And so it takes high concentrations of the gradient to occupy those sites and activate expression. In contrast, the second target gene, called rhomboid, is activated by intermediate levels of the dorsal nuclear gradient in this fairly narrow lateral stripe that runs along the length of the embryo, and on the other side is a symmetric stripe. So you have to try to imagine this. I can't do it. The world is flat for me. But if you could try to imagine this in three dimensions, there are two stripes on either side of the ventral mesoderm running along the length of the embryo. And this stripe coincides with ventral regions of the neurogenic ectoderm. So high levels turn on SNAIL through low affinity dorsal binding sites. Intermediate levels of the dorsal gradient are able to activate rhomboid because it has four dorsal binding sites, and at least two of these are optimal symmetric binding sites that the dorsal dimer just loves to interact with. So lower levels are able to activate the rhomboid gene through the use of high affinity dorsal binding sites. And then finally, the dorsal gradient not only activates genes such as snail and rhomboid, it can also work in a context-dependent fashion as a repressor. And one of the genes it represses is called Xen, and Xen is expressed in dorsal regions of the embryo that will form the dorsal ectoderm. Now, in principle, Xen can be activated throughout the embryo, but it's kept off in ventral and lateral regions by both high and low levels of the dorsal gradient. And the Xen silencer sequence, which is responsible for keeping expression off in these regions in response to the dorsal gradient, contains a series of absolutely optimal high affinity dorsal binding sites that are evenly spaced. So that's more or less the view from 1993. The dorsal gradient generates at least three different thresholds of gene expression, and these readouts of the gradient depend on differing binding affinities of the dorsal transcription factor. Pardon me? Yeah, what is the mechanism of the The dorsal working as a repressor is actually not such a big mystery. There are three optimal high affinity dorsal binding sites in the Xen silencer sequence. And these are, in fact, one helical turn next to an AT-rich sequence which binds to co-repressor sites. And we still don't know what these co-repressors are, X and Y. So dorsal binds to the high affinity sites, and it helps recruit X and Y, ubiquitous silencer proteins, to the neighboring sites. And this is probably a direct protein-protein interaction because you require helical phasing between the dorsal operator sites and the X and Y silencer sites.
Is that protein a Alcuri
has identified several potential candidates that could be the co-repressors. I can say that none of them are sufficient. None of them are grainy head. None of these are sufficient to account for the silencer activity. But the point is that the reason why dorsal is intrinsically an activator, but in the context of Xen, it happens to find itself next to the silencer recognition sequences and helps the silencer bind there and mediate the repression. Dorsal itself is not actually working as a repressor. It's merely facilitating the binding of a silencer protein. But we still don't know the identity. Okay, last thing we knew back in 93 is that the reason why intermediate levels activate rhomboid expression, but high levels of the gradient fail to turn on rhomboid in the ventral mesoderm, is due to the snail repressor. So high levels of the gradient turn on snail. The snail protein is a zinc finger transcriptional repressor, which binds to the rhomboid enhancer and keeps expression off in the ventral mesoderm. Note that snail expression is restricted to the ventral mesoderm. It's only activated by high levels of the dorsal gradient, and that protein in turn represses rhomboid. Sometimes you'll see genes, and you'll see this in the course of my talk, that can be activated by intermediate levels of the dorsal gradient, and they are turned on in both the mesoderm and in these lateral regions. Others are only restricted to lateral regions due to the snail repressor. So you don't absolutely have to have snail repress expression of these type 2 dorsal target genes. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It all depends on, are there snail recognition sequences in the target enhancers?
Well, twist.
Oh, I'm going to talk about twist. Twist figures prominently, as it turns out. We have rediscovered the wonders of twist.
Snail has to fuse up a bit to get all the rural intermediates, or is it?
The snail protein does not appear to diffuse from that localized source, but another target gene that Lewis just referred to, twist, does diffuse. Twist comes on a little earlier before cellularization is complete, so there is the opportunity for some limited diffusion. Where snail comes on a little later, certainly in direct response to dorsal, but it's after cellularization is far along, and so there seems to be less opportunity for diffusion.
Well, is this really very different? Because I've seen sort of twist gradients to be not that far off from where the snail is.
No. Twist, unfortunately, I don't have data pictures, but I do have, fanciful diagrammatic representations. The twist protein definitely extends past this sharp snail border. And that border is at the boundary and defines the boundary between the future mesoderm and the neurogenic ectoderm. And this is, these are the cells that Eric, I'm sure, mentioned, invaginate through the ventral furrow to during gastrulation. But these guys stay on the surface. Yes?
Why is VIN on so ventrally at the pole?
Yeah, that's a good question. Dorsal fails to work as a silencer in that position. We don't know exactly the answer, but there's torso signaling. I don't know if there's been discussed. So the torso receptor tyrosine kinase is activated at the termini, and this seems to somehow block the ability of dorsal to recruit the co-repressor. It's definitely in the nuclei there. There's plenty of dorsal there. It works as a perfectly good activator in those positions, but it fails to silence Zen, we think, because torso signaling leads to the modification of the co-repressors, and so now dorsal can't recruit those co-repressors to the silencer.
Why do you say it works well as an activator here? Give it a snail.
Pardon me? Here?
Look at the...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know this because this is a little later. If you look at twist expression, twist is very symmetrically expressed up at the poles, but not snail. But twist comes up in this position. There's other repressors, Huckabine, that sharpen this pattern up here. You know, that, I'll tell you, in my humble estimation, that is the sharpest pattern to come up in the early embryo. I mean, what does this mean quantitatively? I wish I could be a little more exact. You have a cell here that we would say where snail is on, and a neighboring cell just above it where it is off. Conservatively, that on-off difference means at the very least a tenfold difference in de novo transcription rates. And that's using sort of this nuclear dot, you know, localization to try to make that argument. It could be higher, but at the very least it's a tenfold difference. And I'm going to spend a little time telling you how you create that very sharp border. The dorsal gradient can't do it alone. It needs help.
Okay.
Why is it a little ragged? It sharpens up with time. I really can't answer. It appears to me that snail is uniformly transcribed, and that the protein comes up in a fairly uniform pattern. But we imagine that there could be some spottiness in the way the snail protein is first synthesized in its domain of expression in the mesoderm, and that explains why this is a little jagged. But this definitely sharpens up.
A little later,
oh yes, within 30 minutes this sharpens up. This is 2.5 by 3 hours, it absolutely sharpens up, and you'll see that, actually. Okay, so that's circa 1993. So then the problem basically just was dropped in my lab, more or less. I mean, I still continue to give talks on it, because I have nothing else to talk about, but the problem was more or less dropped. And then about a year and a half ago, a postdoc named Angela Stathopoulos and a graduate student named Michelle Markstein said, look, schmuck, you know, there's new opportunities here. We've got a whole genome. We have the opportunity to do microarray assays, bioinformatics methods, to really try to look at this problem in more detail. And I'm going to leave it to you to decide how much beyond this level of understanding we've achieved using these new methods. So that's what I'm going to spend most of the rest of the talk on. So let me just summarize again what we knew in 93. Genetic studies identified as many as 10 potential dorsal target genes. Maybe half are directly regulated by dorsal, half are not, that exhibit asymmetric patterns of gene expression across the dorsal ventral axis shortly after dorsal enters nuclei. 10 potential target genes. We characterized 4 different cis-regulatory DNAs, including 3 enhancers, and you see 2 here, and then the 1, the Zen silencer sequence. So we had as many as 10 target genes, 3 enhancers characterized as of 93. So, yeah. Yeah, of course.
How important is the length of time to see dorsal? Because, I mean, that comes up with the signaling, especially.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I'm happy to say this is a really very, I mean, relatively speaking, static system. I would say that all the definitive patterns I'm going to talk about are established well within an hour after the dorsal gradient is first formed. Now, you know, so there's some opportunity for second waves of signaling, but there's not, you know, we're not 4 tiers removed between dorsal nuclear transport and the differential regulation of the various genes I'll talk about.
And how long do you need dorsal? Can you then take it away once these guys are on?
You know, we really haven't done that experiment. The dorsal gradient persists through the early phases of gastrulation, so it's there for a while, after the time period I'm talking about. I don't know if it's needed. I don't.
Going
Yeah. I don't know if it's needed, but that's a very good point. It does persist longer than one would imagine needing it, and I don't know if it's functional. All right, so then Angela decided to use a microarray strategy for trying to identify additional dorsal target genes. And the method she used is summarized here. Very simple. So it is possible to get homogeneous populations of embryos that contain uniformly high levels of the dorsal protein in all nuclei in place of the gradient. And I don't want to go into the hideous details. I mean, we didn't have to use any fancy kind of cell sorting and this or that, because dorsal is a maternal gene, and it's possible to get homogeneous populations that are all derived from mutant mothers. Okay, so it's not the zygotic genotype that matters, it's the genotype of the mother that matters. So we can get homogeneous populations of embryos where there's high levels of dorsal everywhere in place of the normal gradient. Other mutant strains will give us low levels of the dorsal protein in all nuclei in place of the normal gradient. And then finally, yet a third class of mutants lacks the dorsal gradient completely. All right. In principle, and you'll see this has been vindicated through additional experiments, this class of mutants here, where there are high levels of the dorsal protein everywhere, overexpress genes like SNAIL, which are normally activated by high levels of the dorsal gradient and locally expressed in the ventral mesoderm. These mutants here, which have low levels of the protein everywhere, overexpress genes that are normally expressed in lateral stripes like rhomboid within the neurogenic ectoderm in response to low levels of the gradient. And then finally, this class of mutants here overexpresses genes like XEN, which are normally repressed by the gradient and restricted to the dorsal ectoderm. So Angela took fairly carefully staged embryos, I mean hand-selected them, so that these embryos are all within 1 hour after dorsal nuclear transport. So she basically took embryos from 90 minutes to 2.5 hours after fertilization, extracted the RNA from each of these three classes, labeled them up, and then hybridized these against Affymetrix chips, which contains the entire protein coding capacity of the Drosophila genome, all 13,601 genes on that chip, and then hybridized them. And these studies appear to have identified as many as 40 new dorsal target genes. So that expands the repertory from about 10 genes identified in the genetic screens to 50 with these 40 new genes. And I'll show you 15 of them on this next panel. My young 12-year-old son gets into my PowerPoint presentations. And like in the community we live in, which is just wall-to-wall lawyers, they're taught how to do PowerPoint before they even talk. And so he goes in there, and he screws around with my stuff. And he has like sound effects, you know, gunshots, and you know. So I try to, because I'm not very talented with this, so I try to purge them. So this little staggering and stuff, that's courtesy of young Aaron. So these are in situ hybridizations, taking the genes that were overexpressed, significantly overexpressed by a factor of 5 or 10-fold or more, in those mutants that have high levels of dorsal everywhere in place of the normal gradient. And a number of these genes were identified. And here you see 5 of the genes were used as probes for in situ hybridization on wild-type embryos. And you can see that they're all expressed in ventral regions, either in direct or indirect response to the dorsal gradient. Some of the genes show some sort of stripiness across the anterior-posterior axis. Others are uniformly expressed. Perhaps genes like MES1 and MES4 are jointly regulated by dorsal and some segmentation
genes.
You know
what those genes are?
I know some of them, and I'll talk about. Yeah, I mean, again, a lot of them are like nucleoside hydrolase. I have no idea, and I don't frankly want to know what that is. Okay. Yeah.
Given the set that you pulled positive from the chip experiment.
Yeah.
What fraction of those then
tested? Yeah, the hit rate was really very good. Angela had different success with the different thresholds. This particular experiment, looking at the chip results with the mutants where there were high levels of the dorsal protein everywhere, I think her hit rate was about 90% of the genes that she tested by in situ hybridization really did check out and show this localized expression. And then she also did spot check where she did in situ hybridizations on the mutants themselves to show that they're overexpressed everywhere. You know, just as a test. It really held up well. This set of genes here that are expressed in lateral regions, that was more like 70% for a variety of reasons. We had a lower cutoff there.
Question about the recessive mutant one, the one that
Yeah.
Part
of the neural
system.
Sure.
I mean,
this guy here.
Yeah, this guy here. Is it like the TOR receptors are inefficient in this?
Exactly. This is a mutant that was identified, I believe, by Schneider and Anderson. It turns out that RM9 and RM10 are exactly the same amino acid substitution in the extracellular domain of the TOR receptor. And the thinking is it constitutively activates the receptor, but it's inefficiently active. So you get constitutive activation in the absence of ligand, but it's only partially active.
It's like a less efficient...
10B. Now this guy is full on in a constitutive fashion, exactly.
Why don't you get the benchmark position then?
No. These are wild type embryos. Is that what you mean?
No, they have like in the talk, in the mental media, they also get the benchmark position.
Hmm?
It doesn't find anything anymore?
No. These really don't show any hint of a bias. These particular, some of the TOL mutants that were characterized in Anderson's lab do still show some response to the localized Spetzel ligand. These do not. Good point, yeah. Okay. So these are five of the genes that are overexpressed in the mutants where there's low levels of dorsal protein everywhere. And roughly speaking, you see they kind of fall into two classes, like the NU1 gene is expressed, among other places, in a fairly narrow lateral stripe in the ventralmost regions of the neurogenic ectoderm, as is NU2. But these two guys, NU3 and NU4, are expressed in very broad lateral stripes in response to both high and low levels of the gradient. So we seem to be getting both thresholds here. Response to intermediate levels of the gradient, response to the lowest levels of the gradient throughout the neurogenic ectoderm. And then finally, here are some of the genes that are overexpressed in the mutants that lack the dorsal gradient. Again, all these genes in wild-type embryos are expressed in the dorsal ectoderm, either directly or indirectly repressed by the dorsal gradient, and we have a hint as to which may be directly repressed by the dorsal gradient. For example, this ECT1 gene comes on early, just like Zen, in a very broad pattern, although it sharpens up later. It comes on so early and it's so broad, it would be a good candidate for being directly repressed by the dorsal gradient, whereas this ECT3 gene comes on just a little later after ECT1, and it already comes on in a fairly sharp pattern. And we have reason to believe that ECT3 and a few of these other genes are not directly repressed by the dorsal gradient, but instead they're regulated by a DPP signaling gradient that dorsal helps establish in the dorsal ectoderm that I think you're going to hear more about later at this meeting. Okay, but I'm going to stick to dorsal. Okay. So the next slide simply summarizes, and this is not the part I want to emphasize, the proteins. I want to get into the cis-regulatory DNAs. But this gives you a partial list of some of the new genes that Angela identified in the microarray screens. And some of the genes that are expressed in the ventral mesoderm that you saw on the previous panel could be components of Eric's FOG concertina G-coupled receptor signaling pathway, which controls cell movements and cell shape changes during gastrulation. This Rho GTPase would be an obvious candidate. Even the insulin-like growth factor and the ABC transporter could be contributing to that process.
And what's the hit rate among 10 non-targets?
Pardon me?
10 non-targets.
We got them all.
You got them all.
Got them all. And that was a very important internal control, which helped Angela fix the cutoff values for, you know, did we need a 10-fold increase before we took the gene seriously or a 5-fold increase before we took the gene seriously? And she used the internal controls of the known genetic targets for that purpose. The answer is a different, you know, so again, in the case of the mesoderm, we had nice clean 10-fold cutoffs. In the case of the neurogenic ectoderm, meaningful genes like rhomboid only showed a 5-fold increase. And when you start trolling around with a 5-fold increase, we only had a 70% success rate when actually tested by the in situ hybridizations. Whereas with the mesoderm, as I mentioned, it's more like 90% because of the higher cutoff. I can't exactly explain why. There must be a little bit of heterogeneity in those embryos. I mean, Angela, you know, was careful. She hand-staged them. She did the experiment several times, but there's still probably some temporal heterogeneity. Several of the genes that are expressed in lateral stripes seem to encode proteins involved in notch and ringless signaling in the neurogenic ectoderm. And then finally, Angela's favorite gene, for reasons that I can't quite understand, is this tumor necrosis-like factor, which is expressed in the dorsal ectoderm. This one is a good candidate for being directly repressed by the dorsal gradient. It is the closest homolog or orthologue of tumor necrosis factor in the Drosophila genome. And so it's possible that that ligand is triggering some kind of junk signaling pathway, which ultimately leads to the demise, the destruction some of the tissues that arise from the dorsalmost regions of the dorsal ectoderm, such as the amniocerosa. And Angela's testing that now, so she's looking at the function of several of these genes. But I want to get away from that and focus on the gene networks, and particularly the cis-regulatory DNA. But if there's any questions on these proteins, they just don't do it for me. These proteins for me are just another pretty face. I'm just not into that. Do I hear the voice of my former postdoc, Daugnitz? I was waiting for you to wake up. I'm not going to talk about the sulfur transferase. I could not begin to tell you what that is. It's something lowly on the periodic table. You know, I mean, it's like calcium, phosphorus, sulfur. Those are rock bottom. No offense, Billy, but I rank those in the bottom. You're not going to report this next week. What the fuck am I doing? Will you guys stop, you know, tempting me to misbehave? I was going to give a straight and sober talk so that Colonel Rothman could go to the other members of the study section and say, you know, that Levine, he's got this horribly flaky reputation, but really, he has data, and he seems to have sobered up in his old age. Okay. Fucked. I'm now going to get into that.
So it's almost surprising that there's so few. Unless
50. No, I'm going to argue that the dorsal gradient primarily does its thing in initiating the patterning of the dorsal ventral axis through the direct or indirect regulation of 50 target genes. And I think that represents the majority based on the thoroughness of Angela's analysis.
And the other possibility would be that had you taken embryos that were older?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Any one of these populations would have shown more and more.
That's exactly right. And Angela spot checked that. And if she takes the older embryos, you know, all hell breaks loose, and you probably are seeing indirect secondary consequences of the dorsal gradient. You start seeing much more precise, sharp patterns coming on immediately later with those genes. So I think we really do have a sense of the majority of the dorsal targets. And of the 50 genes in total identified through the genetics and the microarray screens, conservatively, 25 to 30 of those are likely to be direct targets. And I can show you how we got that number in what I'm now going to say. All right, so now Angela has, remember we had characterized back in 93, Jean Jang, Christine Rushell, Tony Ip, using tedious methods, three different dorsal target enhancers. What I mean by these tedious methods is that you blindly take different pieces of DNA, 5', 3', and the intron of the gene of interest. You don't really know where the dorsal target enhancer is, and then, you know, hook these up to reporter genes and systematically put these into transgenic strains of Drosophila embryos. And it's actually a lot of work, and it's not true that the enhancer of choice is always at the immediate 5' flanking region of the gene. In fact, in our experience, maybe 50% of the time, the enhancer of interest is within the first 5 kb of the transcription start site. The other half of the time, it's more remote, 5', it's in the intron, or it's 3'. Okay, that's based on a lot of, frankly, painful experience. So it took a long time to do those three enhancers. I mean, I'm not trying to make you cry, and I know I'm not going to get Bill here to start crying for me, because I didn't do the work. It was these poor slaves in my lab who did it. But it took a long time, and it made us a little skittish. Like, you know, we would like to look at a bunch of dorsal target enhancers to see if there's any rules governing why one responds to high levels and one responds to low levels of the dorsal gradient, but it's very difficult to get a student or a postdoc, you know, legitimately, to do those kinds of analyses. So Angela took the following approach to try to expand the repertory of dorsal target enhancers. We had these 50 total genes, and she just kind of plucked the low-lying fruit. She, by eye, just looked for really good optimal clusters of dorsal binding sites associated with any of the new genes and old ones identified in the genetic screens, and then just took a DNA fragment, focused around those best clusters, attached them to a reporter gene, and just put that one construct into flies to see if it reconstructed the authentic pattern. So she very quickly got three new enhancers. So we went from three very hard-fought enhancers to very quickly, in no time, another three. So she doubled the number of dorsal target enhancers. So one of the dorsal target enhancers is shown here. And then, remember, she's surveying all the microarray data. And it's not like the others aren't also directly regulated by the dorsal gradient. She just went at the very best ones that she could see by eye. Nothing fancy yet. And so the best cluster of potential dorsal binding sites associated with the MES3 gene, this encodes an insulin-like growth factor. In fact, when you take that DNA fragment, it happens to be located immediately 5' of the transcription start site. When Angela took this and attached it to a LAGZ reporter gene, it gives a faithful pattern of expression in the ventral mesoderm in response to high levels of the dorsal gradient.
It's not what you expect, because you expect fairly lousy binding sites.
Well, you know, these in fact aren't really the very best binding sites. These are not, in this particular case, she felt good about this cluster because they were so close to the start site, and there were four of them. These are in fact not the optimal binding sites, but we had these look like the binding sites in the twist enhancer, so she felt pretty good about them. But you're right, they're not optimal.
Does dorsal interact with each other? I mean, if you put the clusters through, is the interaction between transcription factors?
If you take it, dorsal is a dimeric protein. The best sites, which you don't see here, are really symmetric, like GGG.
Right.
Three or four A's and T's, and then CCC would be the optimal kind of binding site. If you, dorsal intrinsically is a weak activator, and I think this is a very important point that I'm going to come back to in a moment. If you multimerize dorsal binding sites, high affinity, low affinity, doesn't matter, put them on a naive promoter, you know, without anything else, you get very, very weak activation in the ventralmost regions of the embryo where there are peak levels of the dorsal gradient. Even when you do that with the absolute optimal high affinity sites, you don't see expression out in the lateral regions. You see expression collapse into the ventral mesoderm where there are the highest levels of the gradient. It's a weak activator by itself, and it needs a lot of help, and I'm going to talk about some of the factors that help it. Okay. So then another one of the, you know, good dorsal binding clusters that Angela just eyeballed among the set of 50 potential target genes is actually located, and these are pretty high affinity sites. This is located in an intron of the VND gene, and you saw the VND expression profile from Bill in the last talk. And again, this DNA fragment, when hooked up to a reporter gene, gives these fairly sharp, narrow lateral stripes in ventral regions of the neurogenic ectoderm in response to intermediate levels of the dorsal gradient. And this one also has snail binding sites, which keeps it off in the ventral mesoderm. And then finally, Angela took a little bit of a risk with this one. She found three, I mean, these are based on Celex assays and a lot of in vitro binding assays, the best optimal dorsal binding site. She found a cluster of three of them evenly spaced, 15 kilobases, 5' of the transcription start site of this newly identified NU4 gene, and yet this DNA fragment, despite the remote location, does give the authentic pattern when hooked up to a LAGZ reporter gene. Okay, I don't want to belabor this. The main point here is fairly quickly, Angela was able to double our number of direct dorsal target enhancers from 3 to 6, and we're beginning to get multiple enhancers for each of the primary dorsal threshold readouts. And the question that I'm going to keep coming back to is there a threshold code? Do enhancers that respond to the same levels of the dorsal gradient share sequence motifs other than the dorsal binding sites in common, which can account for these different threshold readouts? And the answer is sort of yes, as you'll see.
We're seeing both sides of the embryo in B, in the B down.
And this guy, it's kind of tilted this way, right? So you can, yeah, exactly. There you go. See, there's a little 3D action there. Yes. Okay. I like the side view. I like it all flat. I don't like those extra dimensions. I like two dimensions. Anyway, so then at about the same time, a graduate student, Michelle Markstein, who did not work in a collaborative fashion with Angela, went ahead and, you know, I can't bear all, but my lab is a zoo. It is a zoo. I mean, if you don't go in there with a bullwhip, you can get eaten alive. So now Michelle, it's a very Berkeley story, Michelle did identify new dorsal target enhancers by looking for optimal clusters of dorsal binding sites in a whole genome search. And this was facilitated by, of all people, her parents, Peter and Vicki Markstein, who are senior computer scientists at Hewlett-Packard. And they wrote this wonderful program called Fly Enhancer, www.flyenhancer.org. You can plug in any sequence or combination of sequences you want, and the Fly Enhancer program will spit out, you know, the best clusters, you know, meeting all the criteria that you want to put into it. It even uses Boolean logic and blah, blah, blah. But initially, and boy, this project was a struggle because they did a great job, but it turns out the Markstein's all hate each other, okay? And of course, I needed the data, you know, right? So it's like, can I get a family counselor? You know, I was calling the father, because I'm much closer in age to the father than, you know, to Michelle. I said, Peter, really, what do we have to do here to make this thing work? This, you know, it's going so well. Anyway, it was really, you know, if you don't know me very well, I can assure you that me cast as a psychoanalyst, as a sort of counselor, is not a natural role for me. It's a definite, you might say, perversion, yes. Okay. So, in the initial experiment that the Markstein family did, they look for, and again, not necessarily in a cooperative fashion, but they got it done, was to ask how many optimal clusters of dorsal binding sites containing three sites in a window of 400 base pairs or less in the whole genome. How many of those are there? The answer is 16. All right, not a very big number. Either three or four optimal sites in 400 base pairs or less. And one of these corresponds to the Zen silencer, so it's an old friend, 15 or new. And so Michelle has now systematically tested every one of these 15 new clusters, and at least to my surprise, five of them correspond to authentic enhancers, one out of three. Five of the 15 DNA fragments give localized expression across the dorsal ventral axis and are associated with genes that exhibit the same pattern of expression. So they're authentic enhancers. And many, but sadly not all, but many of them did. But not all, which kind of scares me.
Many of the five.
So how many? You can see I'm not very quantitative here. All right, so the little voice is saying, should I just make up a number, or should I? I don't remember. 4.5. I know off the top of my head that at least three of the five newly identified enhancers is associated with a gene which shows a comparable pattern of expression that did come out of Angela's screen. If there was a little more love in my laboratory, I would know more precisely the number. It's hard to get everyone to sit down and, you know, cross-check.
How do you declare something to be a dorsal binding site? Do they give you with the
consent? Yeah. No. Okay, that's a really important point. So we've done two kinds of experiments. Dorsal is probably the best characterized DNA binding protein. In Drosophila, we have chemical footprint data, Celex assays, and a fair number of enhancers, which have authentic sites that have been mutagenized and shown to be essential for its activity. In this experiment, Michelle biased the screen around optimal sites based on chemical protection assays, Celex assays, and based on what's in the Zen silencer, which responds to the most exquisitely low levels of the dorsal gradient. It's repressed by the lowest levels of the gradient. And so those are the sequences she used.
If you wanted to do a, I were interested in ventral
furrow. Yeah, dorsal can't use those sites. Serosa, yeah.
Then I would use degenerate or sites that work. So
correct. And you know what? And that's going to give you a zoo. And so you need other, it did. So you're going to need other things. Okay, but that's the whole purpose of this, I know, very painful exercise that I'm taking you through. You look like a lot of patients at a mass dental clinic.
So what stringency did you set? You most probably took something like a weight matrix or something.
Nope. Even simpler than that. Even simpler. We took a subset of the whole constellation of dorsal binding sites that, based on lots of information, we knew were optimal high affinity sites, both in vivo and in vitro data. I would say that these represent maybe 10 or 20% of the total spectrum of possible dorsal binding sites we're using this particular experiment. So just a small subset. And to get to Eric's question, but you're going to see, however, we're getting every threshold represented among the five. So we've got these optimal dorsal binding clusters, but you'll see in just a second that a couple of them are expressed in the ventral mesoderm in response to the highest levels of the dorsal gradient. So you will get some ventral furrow genes, to our surprise, that way. If you wanted to go in and use lower affinity sites, you're going to have to ask for clustering with somebody else, with other partners that dorsal uses, and I'm now going to get into that. Because those low affinity sites will give you a mess, and you need more. Okay. So, as I said, Michelle systematically tested all 15 optimal clusters, five are real enhancers, three are shown here. This was not seen in the microarray screen. These two were. And these two, in fact, were known genetically to be probable targets of the dorsal gradient. And again, all you see here is a representation of the clusters of binding sites identified in the computer. Michelle took fairly small DNA fragments encompassing these sites attached to a laxity reporter gene and looked at the transgenics, and these do reconstruct the endogenous patterns of expression. So this quickly took us from 3 to 6 to now 11 different dorsal target enhancers. And this represents, I think, the best sampling of authentic in vivo enhancers defined by transgenic analysis that are all regulated, at least in part, by a common transcription factor. And we think that there's probably no more than 25 or 30 direct dorsal target enhancers strewn throughout the Drosophila genome. So I think we're pushing on getting a significant fraction of these, you know, as many as half of all the dorsal target enhancers are now in our hot little hands. So now we've got multiple enhancers for each of the major thresholds, a collection that only are activated by high levels, another collection by intermediate levels, and another collection by low levels. And we can begin to ask, do they share some common motifs? Yeah, we do have evidence for cooperative DNA binding interactions. If they're closely linked enough, a dorsal dimer bound to one site will facilitate the binding of another dimer to a neighboring site.
How is it that it works at three sites? You might think there might be two or three.
Yeah, in the where this is most needed, I mean, where you want to use this kind of lambda switch model for getting a cooperative increase in the output is on the twist enhancer where there are two low affinity sites. And they work cooperatively, and that does give you a sharper twist output, as I'll show in a moment, in response to a fairly crude dorsal gradient. Yes, Jim?
Now that you have so many, do you see any sort of higher order structure to them in the genome?
You know, I'm gonna discuss this issue of grammar and spacing. And you know, so far we're looking fairly simply at clustering of dorsal sites and clustering of other factors that I'll now mention. And we really haven't seen any obvious, you know, well, in order for dorsal to work synergistically with twist, they have to be a helical turn, or dorsal always has to be 5 prime of it, and they always have to be in this orientation, and you can't tolerate that orientation. We're not. No, I would have to say at least, you know, at a really simple level, no, these are all over. These are all over. And these enhancers that I'm going to show you where you have multiple classes giving the same pattern, they're from unlinked genes, unrelated genes, and if you did a simple blast, you would never see any sequence similarity among the different enhancers.
Is the anterior stripe in the SOG enhancer, is that present in the native pattern?
No. This unfortunately is due to the p-element transformation vector we're using, which for reasons even though we've used it for many years now, we still don't know exactly where the cryptic fortuitous cisregulatory elements are that bias staining up in this head region a little bit. And some enhancers really exacerbate and intensify that staining, and others don't.
So I was wondering if there's a concern about bias, because you started the assumption that you see a dorsal site on as a DNA sequence, but dorsal could just interact with a protein rather than just, you know,
yes,
that sits there. So if you look at your targets,
yes,
any that you think are regulated by dorsal, but don't have dorsal binding sites,
that's a great point. Look, you know, and I'm not presenting myself by any stretch of the imagination as a bioinformatics effort. Now let me emphasize as a disclaimer, and just to be truthful, that everything I'm now going to discuss on the bioinformatics has been done by Peter and Michelle Markstein. I am a computer idiot. I don't understand the statistics, the probability functions that they always are tossing about when they talk to each other. And so I can tell you this, they're doing a lot of this kind of analysis, and they ask the computer to spit out shared motifs. And you see a huge class of guys that have to be dorsal sites. They just have enough of a signature, but there is much more variation in what we are now assuming are authentic dorsal sites that the computer's identifying than we realized before. So sort of going back and asking what kind of dorsal-like sequences do they share in common, very heterogeneous.
But I mean, to take an example, could you build an enhancer where you have a protein that binds dorsal but does not have really direct dorsal binding sites, but would respond now to dorsal by associating with the protein rather than the DNA? You know what I mean?
I do understand what you're saying. I think that's going to certainly be true in a lot of stuff you've heard from Bill and you'll hear from Richard. you know, with the Hox proteins, dorsal is actually quite a robust DNA binding protein. I mean, it's not the lambda repressor, but it is 10 to the 12, 10 to the 13 kind of association constant. And so I think it has a very dominant personality. It could be happening that factor X recruits dorsal to any random sequence in some cases on some of these dorsal target enhancers, but overall, I don't think that's going to be the primary mechanism for most of them, because dorsal is so good at binding. I think it's the other way around. Dorsal gets there, and it'll bring its subordinates, you know, to just about anything next door. Okay, but I didn't call it a master control gene, did I? No, I did not. Yeah?
Most of these patterns, these new patterns, are often a posterior fold. Do they all have a then repressing site?
Yeah, that depends on the stage. A lot of these really do come on. I know you're not going to believe me based on anything you've seen. Many of them really do, as a snapshot, at the earliest times of activation, come on at the poles and then get sharpened up. They get repressed by torso signaling, Huckabine. There's a lot of repressors at the termini. But dorsal is perfectly able to activate the vast majority of these genes at the poles at the earliest phases. Okay, so we have up to 11 target enhancers, and this has turned out, I thought this would be easy. This has turned out to be a lot of work, and that is, okay, you take, in this case, these three different enhancers and ask for what shared motifs do they have. So these are three completely unrelated, unlinked enhancers that respond to intermediate levels of the dorsal gradient and give nice lateral stripes of gene expression in ventral regions of the neurogenic ectoderm. They may not look exactly identical to you, but they're very close. Okay, by this very stringent criterion of in vivo readout in a real transgenic embryo, these patterns are very similar. So Peter and Michelle are developing a program called Mermaid to look for shared motifs. And it turns out, and probably a lot of you guys know this who are bioinformaticists, you get like a telephone book worth of shared motifs, AA, you know, T. So you have to add filters. And choosing the filter has proven to be the trickiest task. But Michelle cleverly made a negative work for her. She's using as the filter the 10 dorsal binding clusters which failed to work, okay, which she systematically tested and which did not, for whatever reason, give localized expression across the dorsal ventral axis. So she asked the computer to find any sequence motif shared, in this case, among these three enhancers that are absent, for the most part absent, in the 10 DNA fragments that didn't work. And that has been very effective. That greatly reduced the number of potential motifs. Maybe we're throwing away good stuff. It's possible we're throwing away good stuff, but at least what we're getting, we feel pretty confident about. And I'll show you the results.
If it works only with one, then it's fine. But if you have more than one, then you can get to use all of them.
Well, we haven't lost all of them. And this guy, I mean, here again, in this particular case, Michelle and Peter asked for motifs that are present in at least two copies in each of these three enhancers. That's legitimate. I mean, I'm sure you've already learned from Eric's talk and others that your typical cis-regulatory module or enhancer, whatever you want to call it, has multiple binding sites for multiple factors. So insisting on two copies of the motif is not a terrible thing. I think it's a reasonable thing. So she and Peter want two copies in each of these enhancers and no more than one in any of the negatives. Okay, fine. So this sequence, which is conserved among these enhancers, actually looked familiar. It just so happened that there was a postdoc in the lab who was doing Celex assays with the twist protein. It was kind of a coincidence. And it turns out that the optimal sequence, the most overrepresented sequence she found in the Celex assays, are exactly this motif, CACATGT. So we're pretty sure that this motif corresponds to a twist binding site, and I'll tell you what twist is in just a second. This just shows that the CACATGT motif is essential for the normal lateral stripes of expression in response to intermediate levels of the dorsal gradient. These are experiments done by Rob Zenson in the lab, but similar experiments were done by Michelle using the similar Brinker enhancer. Now this V&D enhancer turns out to contain a total of 5 EBOX motifs, C-A-N-N-T-G, which generally bind to a class of proteins called basic helix-loop helix proteins. And in the case of the V&D enhancer, two of the E-boxes have the CA core, the shared motif that's found in the other enhancers that give this kind of pattern. The other three have either a TA, and not shown here, an AA core. And we believe that those are low affinity twist binding sites. So in this experiment, Rob has removed the high affinity twist sites, leaving the low affinity twist sites intact, and now you see the pattern collapses into something very similar to the normal pattern of expression of a gene called SIM. The pattern's collapsing into the ventralmost cell in the neurogenic ectoderm. This is slated to become a very specialized cell type called the mesectoderm. It gives rise to glial cells and motor neurons. It's kind of a mixed identity cell, a little bit mesodermal, a little bit neurogenic. And one of the enhancers that Michelle identified in her whole genome screen, SIM, gives a very similar pattern of expression. And the SIM enhancer lacks the CACA motif, but contains a few copies of the low affinity twist binding site. These and other experiments suggest that dorsal's not working alone as a regulatory gradient to produce different thresholds of gene expression, but it's working together with twist, which is also distributed in the gradient, and it's also producing multiple thresholds of expression. And maybe I'm going to have to use sign language to explain this, but two gradients really are better than one, and really do give much more fine-grained positional specification than one gradient could possibly do alone. It is getting bashed around a little bit when you. Yes. No, I think a lot of this is staging. A lot of this is timing. But the SIM line and this mutagenized VND enhancer come up in a very patchy kind of fashion in early embryos, and then becomes fairly uniform a little later. Okay, so here's the idea. And this is based on looking not at synthetic enhancers, but real enhancers among our collection of 11. We know, and we knew this 12 years ago, that the broad dorsal gradient directly generates a steeper twist gradient. Twist is an immediate early target of the dorsal gradient. And it's been kind of controversial as to what, I mean, we know twist is really important for mesoderm formation, but its role in patterning the neurogenic ectoderm has been a little controversial, a little hard, to at least for us, to get our hands on. I think this describes, summarizes very well, our current view of how dorsal and twist work together to generate very precise thresholds of gene expression at that critical boundary, right in that region between the developing mesoderm, where snail is on, and the ventral regions of the neurogenic ectoderm, where the snail is off. So the snail 5' regulatory region contains low affinity dorsal binding sites and low affinity twist sites. And expression is restricted very sharply to the ventral mesoderm. The SIM enhancer, in contrast, contains low affinity twist sites, but high affinity dorsal sites. And that seems to expand it by just one or two cells into the ventralmost regions of the neurogenic ectoderm that form the mesectoderm. And it just so happens that SIM also contains snail repressor sites, which keeps it off in the ventral mesoderm and restricted to those narrow lines in the mesectoderm. But there's other genes, and I'll show you one in a second, which don't have the snail sites, so they're on in both the mesoderm and in that mesectoderm.
Mike, you got the same problem you had years ago with snail explaining too sharp a line in terms of the gradient.
Yeah, no, and there's no question that we have so much indirect evidence that there's something feeding back down to sharpen up that border. It does come up fuzzy, and then it does sharpen up. No, this is not the whole answer, but it helps. This does help, though.
History's repeating itself.
Because if you just look at snail come on, it comes on kind of fuzzy at the borders, and then during a period of about 30 minutes, it gradually sharpens to that fairly precise on-off pattern. And I don't know that the synergy between dorsal and twist, bound to, in fact, these unlinked sites, would be sufficient to convert. Let's put it this way. So snail is on right here. At most, there's a two-fold drop in the levels of dorsal at the critical border, where snail is on and ultimately snail comes off. And in twist, there may be more like a 3-4-fold drop in the level of the twist protein in neighboring nuclei, where snail is on and off. And in a sense, yes, I think these two gradients are multiplied on the snail promoter, but I don't think that's still enough to account for the precision of the on-off switch, but it helps. I mean, it
proved that was true in that wanted out-axis inversion experiment.
Yes.
Where you get that whole.
You get the whole thing. Yes. Yes.
So that's the same argument.
No, but what's new here? I know. So what Professor Davidson is rightfully asking me is, so what's new? You know, after all this work, all this hot air, all this bioinformatics, you know, and I better come up with an answer.
Well,
there you go. Well, there it goes. What's new is the differing binding affinities of the twist recognition sequences and giving these slightly distinct threshold readouts of both the dorsal and twist gradients. What we knew before was just SNAIL. We did not know that SIM and VND were direct targets of twist.
Can you reproduce those without showing even good times?
We have not, yes, in part, yes. We have not reproduced every facet of this, but have reproduced a VND expression pattern by modifying the twist enhancer to include optimal dorsal binding sites, the CA core motif in the EBOX sequence, and some SNAIL repressor sites. No, we have not started from scratch. But we can basically convert, I'll tell you here and now, we could take a 200 base pair twist enhancer, and by making 12 nucleotide substitutions in that 200 base pair enhancer, go from this pattern of expression in the ventral mesoderm to this pattern of expression in lateral stripes in the ventral regions of the neurogenic ectoderm. That must have some evolutionary significance, even though Billy doesn't like cis evolution. I mean, that's a relatively, you know, right? You change 6% of the nucleotides, and you completely change the response of the target gene to the dorsal gradient. Complete change.
I don't understand multiplying because of the dorsal and twist gradient, twist being the readout of dorsal,
yeah,
is different than just having a higher cooperative
binding. Yeah, okay. Here, you know, you're right, but let me tell you how. I mean, this is just an empirical observation. If you take dorsal binding sites alone, as I said, high or low affinity doesn't matter, you get really wimpy expression. You see it, you know, but it's very weak. If you multimerize twist alone, you get nothing. I mean, we've multimerized every one of these various versions of twist. You can mix them together in any way, and we've made several different arrangements, intercalating the two sites, or just a block of high affinity twist and a block of high affinity dorsal, and it goes wild. I mean, you get absolute synergistic activation. A lot of experiments have led me, at least, to believe that dorsal and twist are communicating with different rate-limiting components of the transcription complex. The dorsal, for example, may be recruiting HAT or SWI-SNF to open chromatin. That gives you a little bit of expression, but not much. Then twist comes in, because these loop helix proteins are notoriously sensitive to chromatin. So that's why the specific model, the dorsal helps open the chromatin. Now twist can bind, and twist, for example, recruits mediator to the core promoter to just drive the transcription. And I think that's very elegant. I mean, if we're obviously, I mean, we don't want to go into Tijan's cold room, you know, to actually prove, you know, that's serious work to prove this biochemically. But there's just a preponderance of evidence which suggests that dorsal and twist are communicating with two distinct pathways of transcriptional activation. And this would be kind of a mechanism for multiplying two gradients. Yeah. Pardon me? Yeah, we have now all of these types of enhancers represented among the new ones that were identified. Yes. Yes. I mean, let me just, so what have we learned after all this work of going from 3 to 11 enhancers, doing the mermaid analysis, look for shared motifs, asking, is there a threshold code? You know, yes and no. CACA, TGT is absolutely associated with an intermediate response. Whether it's linked up to a low affinity site or a high affinity site, we're getting activation in lateral regions, either a line or a stripe, in response to intermediate levels of the gradient. So I think that motif is diagnostic for the type 2 threshold response.
And I suppose it's conserving sort of cure?
You know, that's, okay. Now, you're raising another issue. You guys probably know who are into bioinformatics. Every schmo, and in our case, literally, his or her mother and father, are doing these phylogenomic comparisons. You know, somehow you're going to decode the whole regulatory logic of a human You know, you're going to figure out why some of us can curse in Hebrew by simply, you know, comparing mouse and human and looking for non-coding islands of conservation. And this works for a few enhancers, but it's not a panacea, okay? And so we're arguing for a complementary approach, which is also not going to be completely conclusive by itself, and that's to find shared motifs among coordinately regulated enhancers within an organism, as opposed to doing the comparisons with other. We're intentionally avoiding this phylogenomic comparison because everyone else is doing it. We want to try to do something different. Is that horrible? Is that horrible? It is horrible. Okay. I could tell you, well, absolutely. Look, I got to tell you here and now, if you look at pseudobscura, you know, the pseudobscura genome is basically assembled and it's out. I don't care what the pundits say. You know, there's supposed to be neutral selection. Every nucleotide that can change has changed. It's not true. There is way too much conservation. So if we look, for example, at the 5' SIM enhancer in pseudo-obscura, this is conserved, but so is this, 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 and in huge blocks that cannot be explained by our current knowledge of how a cis module works. Too much conservation. For every single one we've looked at.
So some of us wouldn't pseudo-obscura if we hit one. What is the pseudo-obscura?
Oh, Drosophila pseudo-obscura.
How different is it?
I think it's what, do you remember, it's a 40 million, it's supposed to, it's a, you know, it's close to the time of divergence of mouse
is
and human.
Different
the virulus would be more divergent, virulus is farther out, but it's twice the genome size. So pseudo-obscura was the most divergent with the same size genome. Oh, they look, I mean,
you have a hard time telling them apart.
I mean, Eric could probably tell them apart. I could never tell them apart.
You could.
Because I never look at adults.
You couldn't tell them apart?
Oh, no, I throw the embryos away. I throw them away before they hatch. I never look at the adults. I don't look at the adults. It's over. For me, 3 hours, it's over. It's over.
The adults
It's tiny. Okay, I just want to understand. But they separated ages ago.
Not so long.
Not long enough ago, I think, is what is 30, 40 million? 40, 50. I'm telling you, so if we were just to rely, if we wanted to find a threshold code by comparing our identified enhancers and looking for comparable sequences in pseudo-obscura, we would not find a thing. Everything's conserved. And if we look at anopheles, the mosquito, another dipteran, it's so far out there. Oh, we can't see a thing. We can see the coding regions, barely, but we can't.
Like, I don't understand it correctly. So you're saying that every neuroectodermal gene has twist binding sites?
The genes that are expressed in the ventral part of the neurogenic ectoderm in response to intermediate levels of the dorsal gradient. So far, these are Brinker, rhomboid, and VND. They have the optimal twist binding sites.
So
you know, yeah, now the problem with the twist mutants is that it's an intrinsic double mutant. In twist mutants, you lose snail expression. And so now genes like VND can get activated by the peak levels of dorsal in the ventralmost regions. They don't respond to the intermediate levels of the gradient. You absolutely need twists for that. But you can get activation by the high levels now in the ventralmost regions because you've taken away the snail repressor, so it's no longer masking that. Okay.
General question, we think this may be the right time to address it, but if you have a somewhat continuous distribution of dorsal protein,
yes,
and, dorsal protein,
yes.
And you have enhancers that have multiple binding sites with different levels, different affinities.
Yes.
And yet you've talked about three classes of genes.
Yes, we think we're up to four.
The intermediates and the highs.
Correct.
And so, intuitively, I would have thought that you could actually have, and the animal could have easily made
a continuous gradation.
Continuous sets of enhancers that would respond to every level of dorsal as you went around.
Yes.
Now, my question is really, that's probably possible.
But we don't see it.
How sure are you that you... Is it that there are morphologically,
yes,
developmentally meaningful groups of cells, so you tend to evolve enhancers to be of this kind or that kind or that kind.
Absolutely.
And then the other question,
yeah,
is how accurate,
absolutely,
are the boundaries when you make a primordium and you have something like,
yep,
your intermediate, is it, do these 10 different enhancers that do this general intermediate thing and by different binding affinities and different arrangements of dorsal, different number of sites, do they come out to exactly the same, or do they come out to how different?
Okay, so let's look at I understand what you're saying. And you know, we tend to I'm a salt and pepper kind of guy, and it's, you know, it's black or white, and you know, so if you know what I mean, it's kind of naturally. So if you consider, and I know you guys, I mean, Eric is in a coma. I want to wrap this up because I'm losing my audience. I don't want you guys to actually have cardiac arrest, because let me tell you, some of you are getting dangerously close to not hydrolyzing one ATP molecule in a 1 hour duration. That's clinically dead. You're clinically dead if you don't keep the hydrolysis. So we're getting, you know, I don't want to be responsible for some kind of mass death here. So now, but to put
your... because he's not hassling you. He's not in the...
But he's... I don't... I mean, I have never slept as soundly as Eric has been sleeping for the last 45 minutes of my entire life. Anyway, okay. I'm sure it's a deep and nurturing kind of sleep, but I wouldn't know because I can't sleep. Okay. Anyway, so, all right, sorry. No, it's okay. So getting to Eric's question, look, absolutely, we're lumping some enhancers, like these three guys, into one category where there probably is some subtle difference between them. These dorsal borders may very well be different by a cell or two. And could we ever get at that level? I don't think we're going to get it. We're not going to get a code for every continuous, you know, cell by cell readout of the gradient.
Well,
but we do.
Could you engineer?
Because there's not an enhancer for every cell. I mean, we're running out. I don't.
Could you artificially?
Could we do it? Yes.
Could you artificially make?
You know, it's.
It would subdivide the whole.
It's a really.
Of all the possible enhancer arrangements, are they going to be basically uniformly?
Yes.
What we see in evolution is that we've selected certain.
Yes.
We've done our best approximation.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point.
Sets.
Yeah.
And we can't, you know, because we're always doing it differently. They're not always exactly the same, but they're good enough.
Yes. I think the tinkering, I'll tell you, I feel pretty good about this analysis. We are certainly throwing together enhancers that are subtly different each, you know, from one another, but we can still identify classes above the sort of background noise, and we're seeing shared motifs, and we're getting more shared motifs among enhancers of what we would call a similar threshold. I think the tinkering, outside of our, let's say, four major categories, is going to be more subtle than just the qualitative sequences found in the enhancer. It's going to be things like spacing. Maybe you can make this cell, maybe you can get activation and one more cell up here. If those optimal dorsal and twist sites were just a little closer to each other, but you move them further apart, you bring it down. So I think we can find meaningful landscapes, although we're lumping together guys that are subtly different from each other.
So part of the problem is that the data set, even though you've increased the size of your data set,
Three to 6 to 11.
Significantly.
In 1 year, in 1 year of funding from that grant.
It's to answer the kind of questions that we would really like to have a much larger.
Absolutely. I can tell you, you know,
around the circumference.
Sometimes, when we make synthetic enhancers, sometimes we see a graded response to dorsal. You know, where you'll see just activation high and low, more or less following the dorsal gradient. And sometimes we'll make enhancers where it's really sharp. And I can't always tell you why we're getting these different responses among our different constructs.
Sensible question, is it not an easy, but of the synthetic enhancers, are they not random?
Yeah, sure. They're not random. We're biasing the kind of sequences that we're using, of course.
But then, once you've made this, all the possible ones, they would still give you weird groupings that are, in fact, the meat of evolution.
Yes, that's right. I think that's right. I think the very subtle tinkering in there will give you these subtle changes. That's the kind of stuff you want
to
do.
Which will give you a graded response.
We will get a graded response. There's this old experiment Susan Gray did back in 1994. I thought a really pretty experiment. She took optimal bicoid binding sites and optimal dorsal binding sites. And you know, for the most part, there are very few, if any, authentic enhancers that are jointly regulated by these two major maternal gradient systems. She made the synthetic enhancer. And she had, maybe you remember this, in anterior regions where there's high levels of both bicoid and dorsal, she had a very broad pattern, responding to low levels of dorsal, and as you move back, where there's limiting amounts of Bitcoin, the Bitcoin gradient's going down, that baby just got narrower and continuously narrower and narrower. It wasn't a step thing. It was a continuum of expression. Bitcoin plus dorsal. And so she got a response to increasingly lower, increasingly higher levels.
This is your system.
Yes.
APND.
Right.
Are there data to pursue by thinking about the three categories of genes that you talked about as the gap genes of the dorsal ventral axis downstream of which there are genes that refine
yeah.
give you much shorter
yeah, you know, it's I am happy to say, you know, just because of my personality, that dorsal ventral patterning is a much more democratic, non-Germanic, non-hierarchical process than anterior posterior patterning. I mean, I can't help it, it really is. Okay, dorsal is just, you know, spitting out all these different patterns, and yeah, there's definitely some cross-regulation. You know, I mean, snail represses VND, for example, and it's a readout of dorsal. So there's
this democracy issue.
Huh? Did I upset you?
Explain the democracy.
What's that? It's just democratic because a lot of these genes come out and they just start doing their things, kind of more or less independently of each other. Yeah, you don't have, you know, Lieutenant VND then turning on Corporal, you know, IND.
No, sorry, I'm telling you, it's not true.
Follow your network. That's a little bit.
Okay, we're going to get to the network. Look, I literally want to wrap this up, but keep going.
When you got cooked with
I only have two more. I'm just going to cut it back to two more slides. I was going to get into the grammar issue. I was going to show you some immunity, but you know, we'll have to do without it.
Immunity.
Yeah, we'll have to do with it.
I didn't quite understand the import of this five-scale reading out of gradients in the sense, the dorsal sense. But look at your pictures. I see a great.
This
deal,
picture.
I feel a great deal of scatter in say the rhomboid expression.
Yes.
So
yes.
What's the point of? I mean, so that's sort of speak the variance around the mean.
Yes.
Why? I mean, is this the response inherently? I mean, that sort of.
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to represent these data. A lot of that, this variability you're seeing, really are temporal differences. You know, things are happening fast and furiously during the cellularization of the Drosophila everywhere. Most of these patterning genes are deployed and get localized. So literally, if you're off in timing by 5 minutes, the patterns will look subtly different. You know, I can tell you in the case of this Brinker pattern, a couple minutes later, you would see nice uniform. You know, so some of this you're looking at, absolutely, but mainly you're looking at, as best as we can do, a snapshot at the early phases of activation. We're not trying to go into those later patterns.
But seriously, there really seem to be several distinct morphologies of the interface. There is sort of high contrast, the rugged interface like rhomboid, right, as opposed to sort of diffuse interface of some other things, I guess. So the Topple Brinker is kind of diffuse.
And you know what? I think we're going to get into that discussion on considerations of robustness, you know, later in the meeting. There probably are cellular mechanisms for, you know, correcting this kind of stuff. It's just it's not my thing. I mean,
some battery water. I mean, if you measure the proteins with some antibody, you'd see similar diffuseness here and sharp.
Correct. Yes. Yes.
But it could also be a different mechanism in the level of the enhancer.
It could be, but again. You know, every enhancer we've ever worked on, if you look at its onset, it does not come on uniformly in response to the same levels of a regulatory protein in different positions of the embryo. There's a lot of, you know, heterogeneity in the early response of the enhancer. Then things kind of get smoothed out over a few minutes of time. And we're trying to represent fairly early readouts of the reporter gene in these photographs. Okay. I'm sorry I'm dragging this on so long. Just want to make a quick point. We can use the newly identified motifs, in this case the CACA-TGT motif, to identify new enhancers. And I got to say something about that. If we do whole genome screens, and this is getting back to one of Eric's earlier questions, we do whole genome screens now with lower affinity dorsal binding sites, but we can throw in some of these new motifs like CACA-TGT to get a little more stringency there so we don't get as much junk when you just look at low affinity dorsal sites. The best we do in a whole genome screen, no matter how many clusters of how many factors, is 1 out of 3. We get a precision of 1 out of 3 of our hits in a whole genome screen, to the extent that we've tested them, are real enhancers. And we can't do better than that. As we get clustering of more and more factors, some of you might know of a paper that Mike Eisen was the senior author of, Berman et al., that looked at segmentation enhancers. And if you look at the fine point of that paper, once again, we're looking at clusters of gap proteins and Bitcoin and Hunchback, 1 out of 3, at best, 1 out of 3. If you're asking for simple clustering, you're going to get 1 out of 3. Now, having said that, We think we can nail every single dorsal target enhancer in the genome by cheating, by using the microarray data. So if we use that as a reference, and we start looking at clustering of even crappy dorsal sites with some of the newly identified motifs, we can always find our man. And this is an example. This gene, CG12177, encodes a nucleoside hydrolase. It's expressed, that's my favorite, it's expressed in the ventral mesoderm and actually extends to the single line in the mesectoderm, in the sim line. Now, if you just look at that gene in microarray and scan 30 or 40 kilobases around it, including its intron and everything else, and just ask for two crappy dorsal binding sites, there's a lot of different places where you'll find two potential cruddy dorsal binding sites. There's no places, by the way, where you'll find even one high affinity site. So you ask for two cruddy low affinity sites, there's a lot of potential enhancers. If we then throw in this sequence, CACATGT, we get one and only one candidate enhancer, pluck out that fragment, and you get your man. And this has been true now for quite a few enhancers that Angela and Michelle are testing. These are two enhancers, SOG and NU4, that respond to low levels of the dorsal gradient. Once again, mermaid analysis identified a sequence motif. We have no idea who binds to this motif, GCT, GGAA, but when mutagenized, you disrupt the pattern. I don't know to what extent we're changing the threshold response of this target gene to low levels of the dorsal gradient, but clearly this motif is binding some factor that's important for the overall pattern. So just to summarize, the analysis I described, the combination of microarrays and bioinformatics, and now I think we've gone beyond the 11 enhancers that I mentioned to about 15 of the dorsal target enhancers by using the new motifs like the GCTGGAA motif, the CACATGT motif with the microarray data. So we're probably up to 15, and I think we can get them all. Based on the analysis of all these enhancers, this is our summary of how the dorsal gradient actually works. Activation of gene expression can be achieved really by two separate codes. Either clusters of high affinity dorsal binding sites, and nothing obviously, you know, shared in common outside of these optimal dorsal binding sites. There must be other stuff, but these seem to be adequate for giving activation of the ventral mesoderm in response to high levels of the gradient. Or, if you want a sharper pattern, as we see for snail, you need the low affinity dorsal binding sites and the low affinity twist sites. Low affinity dorsal binding sites by themselves do not do anything, as far as we can tell, either with synthetic enhancers or the real ones. There are two different codes for activation in that single line of cells in the ventralmost regions of the neurogenic ectoderm in the mesectoderm, and that is either low affinity dorsal sites and high affinity twist sites, or conversely, high affinity dorsal sites and low affinity twist sites. And then you got this deal with plus minus snail. About half the genes we've seen that obey these codes have snail sites, the other half don't. The half that don't have the snail sites are expressed in both the mesoderm and the mesectoderm. The half that do have the snail sites are only expressed in those narrow lines in the ventralmost regions of the mesectoderm. And I think that reflects the fact, as I said before, that the mesectoderm is kind of a hybrid tissue. Some of the genes are also expressed in the mesoderm, others aren't. Threshold 3 is shown here, high affinity dorsal binding sites and high affinity twist sites. And so far, the four enhancers that fall into this category, the three I described and a new one that was identified during the microarray screen, all have snail sites. In principle, they don't have to, but because they're separate, but they have snail sites. And this allows them to respond to slightly lower, the optimal dorsal and twist sites allows them to respond to slightly lower levels of the dorsal protein. What can I say about this fourth threshold response, activation by the lowest levels of the dorsal protein? So far, sadly, we only have two enhancers for this. We think we've got a beat on a third, and that'll be very illuminating because when you do a little triangulation, you get much cleaner data on finding shared motifs. So right now, we've got kind of a zoo of potential motifs when we just compare SOG and NU4 alone. I told you about the GCTGGAA motif. These optimal dorsal binding sites in both enhancers really do show a periodicity, not the same periodicity. In the SOG enhancer, they're separated by 80 nucleotides, and in the NU4 enhancer by 30 nucleotides. But there is regularity in the spacing, and in the spacer region are copies of this newly identified GCTGGAA motif. So we're getting the sense, but our data set's not large enough, that to get activation by the lowest levels of the dorsal gradient, you need a higher order structure in the enhancer than simple clustering of dorsal and twist binding sites. And I think that in terms of going from our 1 out of 3 precision rate in finding clusters and whole genome screens using fly enhancer to higher, to 50% or more, we need more grammar. simple clustering won't do the trick. We need some kind of spacing, helical phasing requirements, orientation. Maybe dorsal always has to be distal to the GCT motif to work in order to get a higher hit rate. And we've actually achieved that. What? You know, I'm telling you, the other factors, for whatever reason, are not helping us. Even if we go in there, because I haven't shown all the shared motifs we've identified, there's another shared motif, RGG and CAG, which is present in genes that are activated in both the mesoderm and in the ventral neurogenic ectoderm. When we throw that in, along with dorsal sites of various affinities and CACA, TGT, we get the same stinking 1 out of 3 precision in a whole genome search.
Nonetheless, it binds something.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are more, but what I'm saying is simple clustering of those more motifs and those more proteins are not improving the precision beyond 1 out of 3 in a whole genome search. But again, we can nail them all using microarray data, and there's a lot of microarray data out there, so I'm not worried from a practical point of view of identifying all the enhancers. The theoretical, the philosophical question is there a discernible cis-regulatory code where you can just read through the Drosophila genome and immediately infer the kind of, whether it's a dorsal target gene and what threshold readout you're going to get by simple sequence inspection, and we're just not there.
I don't think that the test of whether your algorithm works better by including another target site is a fair test of whether that other target site is part of the system.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not arguing that. I can tell you this.
So if there is another target site, it's part of the code that means that we're not focusing. We're focusing on too small a number.
And I can tell you, there may be a higher order structure to these enhancers that we're simply missing. And we have to sit down and look at that more carefully. I'll tell you this, and I know I have to let you go, but in the immune response in Drosophila, if you infect maggots or flies with bacteria, they turn on a bunch of genes in their liver, their fat body, and there, Kate Sanger in the lab has identified 2 major transcription factors that are important for that activation, and they show real phasing, spacing, and orientation requirements. And she can go and do a whole genome search, and she can identify more than 50% of the positive hits using these other considerations of spacing correspond to authentic immunity enhancers. So by using a little grammar, by insisting that the REL binding site has to be 5' of the GATA binding site, and that seems to be the case for all the enhancers she looked at, you all of a sudden start boosting up the precision. So the more grammar, the better precision. Okay. And of course, I'm not going to even comment on this, but Eric will kill me if I don't show it. That's, of course, the Davidsonian view of dorsal ventral patterning. Maybe we'll have an open discussion about this. I mean, you know, for me, and I'm serious, I can't read maps. There's just something about, my neural processing where I really have trouble. It's purely a visual thing. I have trouble following these. I'm speaking for myself. On the other hand, I have to say, that, and Eric made this himself, just showing, dorsal turns on twist, and then you see all the linkages, dorsal and twist work together to regulate all these various genes, snail, roe, sim, sog, so forth. I think there is a value in presenting the data in this way. And perhaps we'll discuss this at 2 o'clock on the evolution thing. It would be great. I mean, for example, the Anopheles genome has been sequenced. It's a dipteran. Its dorsal ventral patterning is similar but distinct from Drosophila dorsal ventral patterning. For example, amniocerosa seems to arise from both dorsal and a little bit of ventral regions in Anopheles. So there'll be differences. And what would be wonderful is if we can build these kinds of networks, and by the way, this is obviously simplified, this could be expanded to include 40 or 50 different genes, to build the dorsal ventral patterning network in Drosophila, and then build a comparable network in something like Anopheles and explain the morphological change based on changes in these regulatory linkages. That is a doable problem, and I'm sure Eric has mentioned this, this is a more rigorous way to approach, evolution as a problem of gene networks. I just don't know how to represent these networks in a way that I personally could deal with them, okay, because I can't deal with that.
I think we can. Do you want to ask him this?
Can I just ask one question? In the previous slide, when you were showing these enhancers, early on we talked about genes actually repressed by dorsal.
Yes.
Are any of those enhancers?
We have only begun to do we have several silencers, and we've only begun to do the analysis there. So I really have nothing I can share with you in terms of conserved motifs in Zen, DPP, and some of the target regulatory DNAs that are silenced by the dorsal gradient. It's nothing, it's just happening now.
Mike, that was terrific.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, we got it. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. That was beautiful.